So hi, I'm here to talk how to build systems at scale, how we build it in the past, how the future is looking like, and how to scale that out. There's a lot of false info around, but don't despair. There's help around. As you can see here, the little tugboat trying so hard to prevent the catastrophe, or the little helicopter. Have a seat. All right. So, first, a little bit about me. I'm Andreas. I've been doing IT now for around about 2 decades or so. I hang out a lot at the CCC. I've been to nearly every FrostCon so far. Thanks very much for having me. It's always great to be here. In the past, I've been very privileged to be at a small Amsterdam startup called Booking.com when we grew that one each year, 60% year over year. So we started out with a few machines, a handful of people, 5 people in the office. And we ended up being the world's largest hotel booking site with, I think by now, 10,000 people, billions of revenue each year. And this talk is a little bit based on what we experienced there, where we've seen what works. And what we see nowadays is very much hyped in the newspapers or the CIO Weekly magazine or anything, the area, or if you read Twitter or Hackers News, it's not all accurate, in my opinion. So that's why the talk is contain yourselves, think before you follow the herd. Since I did the booking gig, I've stepped out a little bit from daily operations. I nowadays do a lot of information security in the financial industry. Which is very good because it allows you a little bit of reflection. You're not involved day to day anymore, so you get a good overview. And while doing that, I've seen, as I said before, I've seen what works and what I would consider a waste of time. So let's start with the good old days, right? A little bit, have a look back in time. We all know the good old days. Everything was made from wood. And it was so much better, right? You can see it nowadays too. If you follow some people on Twitter, they go like, you know, I'm not up for all this IT shit anymore. It's horrible. The people are horrible. Technology is getting worse and worse. I think I'm seriously considering woodworking. Unfortunately, it's wrong. The old days, they were not really better. I would say they mostly sucked. If you look at corporate IT, you had processes. IT was always the gatekeeper. IT's job was to prevent people from doing work. There's the old joke from Dilbert. I think it was Mordack, the preventer of information. IT was seen as a cost center. You had chargebacks. You had all these processes, which at the end of the day kept your people from actually getting work done. Everything was horrible. There were so many silos. You had the typical life cycle for an application in a company would be you have the architects, they design the software. You have developers who write the software. There will be consultants who install the whole stack. And afterwards, it's handed all over to your operational team to run it and the users to use it. But the users actually just hate it because it's so bad. Bugs get fixed. Yes, of course. Bugs get found first, then they get fixed. Eventually, usually. There's a 6 months time between releases because it's so complicated. Every release, you take down the website for 2 days or something because you need to reinstall everything. And if you're lucky, you get the bug fixed in time because there's QA review, then the change advisory boards needs to agree that this is important. It needs to be tested again. And maybe the test was not correct. So it's actually not, it's not going to happen this year. It will be next year. As I said, it's really horrible. It was kind of like IT done by checklist. Here's the checklist. Monkeys, go do the checklist. You'll get bananas at the end of the day. Not a good time. So since then, things got better. We got the thing. It was the internet. And the internet is really, really great. We know all the song. Things have been really tremendously increased in speed. We got the web applications. You have call it web native software providers. They don't run a brick and mortar store. They only have a website. They can do upgrades every day. Stuff gets improved and delivered to the customer immediately. One rollout, 5 minutes later, the world has seen the new feature. You don't need to test it anymore that long. You don't need to ship it out. You don't need to bug the customers with upgrades. And you see even Microsoft following with that with the Windows 10 policies, where upgrades are mostly updated automatically. You see software like Salesforce as a software as a service application being very successful because they can roll out new features so much faster than Oracle apps or any of the other SAP comes to mind, or other ERP systems. So this seems to be a real success. So everybody wants that. You have old companies, brick and mortar stores, enterprises, they see these web applications or websites and they go like, this works really great, we want that too. But they can't compete. They have their 6 month cycles, everything is complicated, they have the processes, and suddenly a web startup comes along. They are much quicker, they can deploy quicker, they can do upgrades quicker, they write new features. There's a new article in the news or a new hype, they can pull it out in, say, a week or something. They have something which works. Customers flock to it because it might not be perfect, but it works, and I'm so much quicker. With Oracle, I need to wait 6 more months or something, and maybe I don't get it, or it works, but I need to buy another one. And that's the concept behind the disruption by web startups. Your web startups are faster, more agile, leaner than your old companies, and they eat their lunch. Uber is a much touted example. It's not really a very ethical company, but they seem to be very successful with getting the message across that they are much better than the current taxi industry. But it's quite important to see how was that done, right? Let's do a quick recap how the web native companies can be that quick. First of all, they do generally need a very, very clear business objective. What is it that you actually want to solve? For booking, for example, it was a very simple idea. The idea was, let's make it very easy for customers to book hotels worldwide. That fits into one sentence, that's all you need to know. Because at that point, your people can decide that, okay, if this is what we want to do. In my area of responsibility, I see these 3-4 issues which prevent people from doing that simply, because there's too much confirmation needed, there's too much paperwork to be done. Can I find a way around it? Can I fix these things? With such a simple message, everybody can basically take charge or can ownership of these issues and get them out of the way, make the booking experience easy. So this is the one part you need. But you also need a very clear tactical objective. That could be allow quick rollouts of new features. We want to make sure that a developer is able to roll out a new software feature he writes it in the morning. Say, typical example could be, we have a project owner who understands the business part of the application. He has an idea. It would be really cool if we could try this out. He finds a developer in the morning who's available. Maybe it's a new Scrum run or so, and he has one. He talks with the developer. The developer says, you know, that'll probably take me 3 hours. So by lunch, the developer starts, and he's done by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Wouldn't it be nice if we can just try it out and see if it works? So the idea is the developer should be able to roll it out without any interaction, say in 30 minutes tops. That's a good feature or tactical goal. In the beginning, we had this, it worked fine in development, let's throw it over the wall to production operations, and the other alternative is, it works on my machine. The typical example from systems operations to that would be, really, works on your machine. Awesome. Copy your email off. Your notebook goes to the data center. Not really that good. It's what I said before, the development rights operations ones. It's very difficult to scale out at that point because you will have too much friction. There's, again, the tickets between teams and all that. So they decided this will have to go. To scale out, development needs to go faster. We can't wait for operations to do these things, to do the 1 hour install, take down the website for 4 hours. That will not work. So development got a lot of interesting, processes or different changes in processes. There's agile programming, there's scrumming, there's extreme programming, pair programming, name your poison. There's several in the industry for the development process. The idea behind all those is find a way to make it clear what the priorities for development are, have them write the software without any further distractions from the customer, changing requirements, for example, which you will have that the customer thinks, you know, it would be really nice if that color could be red. And tomorrow, no, I thought about it. It's blue is really nicer. Or maybe mauve, can we get green maybe? That's not a good way because you're hunting after the customer. For that situation, Scrum is actually really good because you define a requirement and then you have 2 weeks to implement it. And afterwards, it's demo time and the customer can say, yeah, that's okay. Or no, I would really like the green. And then it's like, okay, absolutely, we can do the green. Where do you want it? Is it that important? Does it need to happen right now? Or should we put it on the back of the backlog? Because remember, if we do it right now, that means the next 2 weeks we are doing green. And very often the customer at that point will decide that, you know what, it's fine with the red we said before. It's more important that we get a new feature installed or so. That works quite well. But once the code has been written, it needs to go out to the service because you're a web company and you want to roll out the features again, right? That's the tactical goal. Deploy code quickly. So this needs to be automated. Code deploy is a typical example. We want to automate the code deployments. This allows for the faster and easier deploys, as I said before. You look into different options. You might start small with an SSH copy or so. You just copy the code to the website, restart the web server. All is good. If you're working a bit larger, say you don't have 5 web servers, you have 100. That takes a bit longer, so you might want to parallelize it. Use PSSH or PSCP. Maybe you're looking at rsync because the data is getting larger. So depending on your needs, there are different options, right? You need to find the right ones for yourself. While the developers people are doing that, the operation people haven't been lazy either, right? They've been busy as well. They've been automating machine configuration changes. There's Puppet, for example, for that. There's Chef. There's Ansible is one of the greatest ones. There's Salt. Maybe you're still using CF Engine, right? Or potentially you might even have written your own shell scripts. Not the wisest decision because you need to suddenly support your whole infrastructure, but yeah, shell script works. There's even a configuration management system written as a joke called Just Damn Shell Scripts. It's on GitHub. It's if you're into shell, it's a nice way to fix it. Otherwise, I would recommend go for the real one, Chef, Puppet, Salt, Ansible. Those are the decent ones. You're also looking at automating machine installations because it really doesn't scale well if you have to send someone out with a on sneakers with a disk to the data center and go like, disk goes in, install, disk goes out, next machine. That's not good. You would be looking at PXE, network booting, remote installations, maybe using ILO, whatever your hardware has. Or if you're lucky and you're using Amazon, well, there's a REST API, you can just install your machine. Maybe you work with a golden image, maybe you want to install by scratch. It's really up to you. You can completely decide what you want. Personally, I'm not a big fan of the golden images one because I find it lacks a little bit the agility. Because if I want to update one package or so, I would need to respin an image, then roll it out to everyone, reinstall everything. If I use a regular, say, Puppet for my package management, it just package added and 30 minutes later I'm done. I don't need to reinstall the machines, I'm good. But it's up to what works for you. The benefit of all these things is that you get a repeatable and transparent configuration change applied. It doesn't matter if it's a single machine or 100,000 machines or a million. It doesn't matter if it's on bare metal or on the cloud, change root, LXC, Docker, makes no difference at all, right? Provisioning should be done in under 5 minutes. There are companies who have, if they're working with bare metal, they know exactly their capacity planning. They have every quarter they buy new hardware for 100,000. They know how much they need this quarter. And if you need a machine, it's already running in the racks, just connect to it. Other people might be deciding, okay, you know what? We can live with a higher latency for scale out because HP delivers, takes say 5 weeks, right? If you know we will need something in 6 weeks, that might work for you too. If that's not working or you can't afford having the spare hardware around, go look at cloud, look at virtual DigitalOcean. Hetzner might be something decent in Germany. There's, again, thousands and thousands of options. It's all up to you. The idea behind all this is it's called infrastructure as code. It's a term formed by Etsy, who've been revolutionizing the eBay for handcrafting things, and they've been very, very successful at pushing the message how they work, and they've been very active at conferences like Velocity or Monitorama. Generally, I would suggest it's an interesting talk with them. If you ever meet any of the engineers, have a good talk. They generally know what they're doing. It's always very interesting to get new ideas how other people are working on it. Afterwards, you deployed your code, right? You probably want to test it. This is not a joke. That's what a lot of people do, right? Because where are you going to test it? Are you going to test it in a special testing environment? How do you make sure that the testing environment is actually accurate to your production environment? How do you make sure that the load, that you get a good understanding how your load is behaving, right? You've just rolled out a massive change to your SQL layer. Can I tell how that will be behaving? I would need to get an exact copy of my environment. I would need to get an exact copy of the behavior of the users. I might be able to sniff some traffic, replay it on my testing environment. I can basically spend a lot of time trying to recreate my production environment, but generally I will always forget something and my testing might not be as accurate or anything. So a lot of companies have decided, you know what, we're just going to test in production. We are going to build our application in such a way that we can survive if a server fails during a test and the customer will not notice. They have decided or they have found a way. For example, at Booking was that every Wednesday they did a capacity test in production. It meant that you would take one cell, which is a set of web servers and a database or and a number of database servers, and you would just increase the priority in the load balancer so that they get more and more and more and more traffic. And at one point, you see that response times go up. So at that point, you know, okay, we're done. We have found the capacity ceiling of that cell, and we have 100 of those cells. So we can take the number of requests we could serve with this one cell, multiply it by 100, and we know what we can do. And at that point, you know, if, say, August is your peak load, you can then decide, you know what, August, we're here. This is what we'll see in August. We're currently growing. We are safe. Or it'd be, I might need to talk to management that either we now spend time on fixing some performance issues or we just buy new hardware. Maybe hardware is actually cheaper. Who knows? It really depends on your situation. So at that point, best do it in production. It doesn't get more realistic than that. And is it risky? Absolutely. It has a certain amount of risk. I would not recommend it, for example, for a metal manufacturing company. Probably not the best idea. Airbus, no, I would not recommend to test out the latest code right on the production suite. But for a web shop, yeah, absolutely. Banks, maybe not on the money path, but if you're working on a PR site or a landing page for a microsite, yeah, why not? Might be good enough. Again, it all depends on your situation. And if you take all these things and you add them together, you get this, oh my God, it's DevOps, right? To make all this work and satisfy the business objective, you can't continue with the old style anymore. You need to abolish the silos. They don't scale. They are horrible barriers to entry. They make your life miserable, basically, and they slow you down. So you need integrated teams where your developers and your operations people, and they do work together. They know each other. They talk. They sit together in the same corner. They have full responsibility for the whole stack. You can't just go development's over there, operations there, the us versus them doesn't work anymore. You need to get rid of that. The old style where you had the build, run, deploy, or what I explained earlier with the consultants, the architects, and all that needs to go. That needs to be one full team. And if you do that way, you can actually deliver the velocity and agility you want. You would say normally this is common sense. You know, it's really important or really good that your developers and your engineers talk to each other. But it's actually very rare in a lot of companies. That it's so rare that there's this joke. It says, common sense is so rare, it ought to be a superpower. And DevOps, what I said earlier, the name, has basically codified all these ideas. Have your people interact with each other, have full and shared responsibility, have a transparent stack. One team, it supports the whole stack in a transparent manner. That's the idea of DevOps. And it's not a tool thing, it's basically how you interact with your people. It means failure needs to be accepted. Because if you are working that fast, yes, you will fail from time to time. And that needs to be well understood that will happen. At Booking, for example, we had a budget. Each quarter was 100,000 euros or half a million or whatever it was. We'll lose this year through human failure. And that's totally accepted. That's just the cost of doing business. And that's a price we are totally willing to pay because it allows it to be so much faster than the competition. And the budget for failure is, for example, something completely new in the airline industry. Even for the non-critical parts, it's just not done. And when they heard about these things, they were like, that's actually a really interesting thing. I'm not sure we could get that into our culture. You basically need full support from your management team to make that work. But if it works, you're going to be very quick. The typical success stories for this would be Etsy, Booking.com, Facebook, Google, Amazon, Netflix, all these very large, very successful companies do the DevOps thing in one way or another. But there's also smaller ones, startups, tons of companies here. If you talk to them, they actually explain how they work. And it's very, very much the similar thing. So yeah, that's basically what works. But if you look at it, there's a fascinating observation. Because if you look at the way people are incentivized, what worked for them, where are their bonuses, and how do we judge their work? You'll see that development and ops, while they are in the same team, they still have very different incentives. Your feature development is generally purely results-driven. It doesn't matter how they got to the code they got. Doesn't matter if they had to take shortcuts or if it's ugly code, beautiful code, really does not matter. The important part is the feature is there. Or it might be that, hey, you know what? That release here is 5% quicker, which is really good because it saves us from having to buy 10 more machines this year. It will be great. It doesn't matter that the SQL query is not the nicest or that they used copy and paste from somewhere. For your operations, however, it's a very different game. The result is not actually that important. It doesn't really matter if the deploy was error-free or if it had to be rolled back or anything. Was the code nice? Was it not? No effect. The important part is that it's well understood how they got from the old release to the new release, that this is repeatable, that they can do it not just on one machine, that they can do it on all machines, that they can roll it back, that they can verify, was it successful? Is it running? Is it running well or is it not running well? These are all things which are important for ops, but not for development. Chris Kerntop, former colleague of mine from Booking and a good friend, explained it very nice yesterday in his talk, go away or I shall replace you with a nice shell script. He says the infrastructure development operations is judged by the worst case, while the feature development is judged by the best case. For feature development, it's always, oh, this is really awesome. This is a nice little feature. For kernel development, as you can see on the Linux kernel mailing list, they never ask, hey, this is a really cool feature that looks really nice. How does it work in the best case? The scheduler, for example, is always, so what's the worst case? How much worse will it get if we apply that patch? Where are the bugs? How bad will it crash? That's a not necessarily the most rewarding experience. You've just written a new patch, you're super proud, and they go like, yeah, so how does it break? I assume it's not for everyone, right? But be that as it may, we have amazing new tools, right? The future is totally awesome. Because nowadays we have containers. They solve all these things, and specifically we have Docker, which is the best ever. This is Dan Walsh from Red Hat, who does a lot of work on Docker and getting it secure, because by default it isn't. And he always explained that it's Docker, Docker, Docker. You need to say it three times. It works really well. And as I said, we have this amazing new technology called containers. The most famous example would be Docker. And they promise to solve all the examples or all the problems I just described before. You can solve it with one tool. It's amazing, right? Because all your code, you don't need to worry about applications or machines anymore. All your code is nicely contained in an application container. You load it on a boat, and the boat goes, and that boat goes to production, and there it's installed, right? You don't need to worry about dependencies. You can deploy it anywhere because every container is the same. Doesn't matter if you're running it on a Linux machine, on a Windows machine, or whatever. It's all in there. It's amazing, and best part, it just works. That's most important. So if we look closer, what Docker actually does, we can have a look at the website. That's what Docker says. It's straight from the website, and it's an accurate portrayal of how Docker is used. Don't worry so much about reading it, because I highlighted the important parts. As we can see, it's a platform for developers and sysadmins to assemble applications from components and then get it deployed into production as fast as possible, right? Sorry? No, it's actually not that bad if you look at it, right? It doesn't talk about synergies, it doesn't talk about web scale, it doesn't have React, MongoDB, whatever. So it's kind of okay, right? It's a decent description, I would say, but there are problems with that. Because, for example, here I see it's developers and sysadmins. So both, the whole DevOps thing, really great. And here it talks about getting code and deployed to production. So wait, that's not what sysadmins do, that's what developers do, right? And it's actually a little bit, it allows the developers to pack up code into production. Well, haven't we seen that before? And I'm not talking about the old joke about the write once, run anywhere from Java. No, I'm more thinking like, you know, work fine in dev, it's ops problem now. It sounds a little bit to me like here's a binary blob. It works on my machine, go install it now in production. And it feels like we've seen that before and we've decided in the past that that's not the way we want to work. It does not work. And I had thought we had gotten completely rid of that attitude. It brings the old joke to mind as well. If you don't understand package management, you're forced to re-implement it badly, because that's exactly what Docker is being pushed at or hyped as. It's package up your code, ship it to production, it'll work. And I'm a bit surprised, actually, because the technology behind Docker is, it's not the best, but they actually managed quite nicely to get it to the masses and get containers ready for use. Yet all they seem to be interested in is packaging software and managing dependencies. Now that's something which has been solved 20 years ago, 15 years ago, with apt-get, RPM has solved with yum.
Not really.
Yeah, I would say. But
what they do and what all the Java and .NET and whatnot try to do is not only deliver you the application itself, but the runtime environment as well.
Yes, but that's where it fails. Next slide then, right? no problem, no problem. But the dependency in software packaging, that's well understood, right? Especially if you're within a company. It's a little bit better, or it's a little bit different on the wider internet. For example, when you have these nowadays, these appliances, VMware appliance or so, it's downloaded, test drive this piece of software. At that point, Docker actually makes a lot of sense. But for rolling out applications in enterprise, don't think so. And I'll explain why. So recap, the failboat. We have a tool which completely ignores the best practices we've learned in the past on building scalable infrastructure. We are not doing the teamwork anymore. We are having a development team which is packaging software in some way, right? Nobody knows exactly how it works because there's this Docker file, but there isn't actually a guarantee that what you're getting in the Docker file is actually what's described in the build file. Docker is working on signing things, but again, that's just more like, yeah, it's really coming from the person who claims it's coming from, but it's not a guarantee that what you're getting there is actually accurate or something. You're getting a binary blob applied on top of another binary blob. If you look at the examples, you'll find something like, let's take this cloud image, we'll add this cloud image binary from Ubuntu, we'll add this Apache binary on top, and we'll take the MySQL binary on top, and then we'll add a few more config files, and we got a ready-made web server. The problem is there's no guarantee that if I build that with the same Docker file in 2 months again, that I'm getting the same, because maybe you grab data from daily binaries, right? Or you've seen their Debian Docker files where code is downloaded and installed via tar.gz from the daily builds. There's no guarantee that what you're getting is actually recreatable or anything.
And it's completely unclear whether you are adhering to any company standards or not.
That too. But on the other hand, if you're building your own, you're probably safe with that, because you can make sure that your people, that the application at least you're collecting is applying to your company standards. But let's say if you take the base Ubuntu image, you are most likely safe, but I'm not sure if you're safe enough for your lawyers, for example. And that depends, again, on company size, right? The interesting thing is we've kind of had that before, that you're getting your binary blobs applied on top of binary blobs and then shipped into production to run applications. we had about 40 years ago. It died 25 years ago, and it was called Smalltalk. And there's a good reason, because shipping a system state in time has never really been really manageable and has been a good idea, because Smalltalk tools were often written in a way that here's the code, but you know, we just live patched it, packaged it up, and that's what you run. Not a good idea. Typical example in a company, for example, is imagine you have a park of Docker, or you have a nice environment of thousands of machines, very heterogeneous, and you wonder, okay, how many machines with Heartbleed, OpenSSL, or Shellstock Bash do we actually have? If you're a old-style enterprise, you can ask your, say, your Red Hat Enterprise satellite server, they know, and you can fix those machines. If you're running Puppet, there's Factor, it knows the answer to that. If you're running Chef, Ohio knows the answer. If you're running Ansible or Salt, there's an answer for that too, right? It's all managed. If you run Docker, the answer, unfortunately, is who knows. There's no reproducibility, and there is no way to tell what's in your package, which becomes a bit of a problem if you need to decide, okay, it's time to re-roll those packages or those images or not. You can fix that by installing Puppet in your images, for example, but that's not really smart, because suddenly it's not an application container anymore. You're actually building a full virtual machine in Docker, and at that point, why do you bother anymore? Can't you just package up the code and async it to your destination, for example? But the good news is, even if it would be horrible, right? It can't be that horrible that it can't serve as a bad example to others. And that's actually the sad thing I find in Docker. The technology is okay. There are really good use cases for containers, and Docker successfully managed to get a better interface in place than the Linux containers, LXC. If we look at, for example, the CentOS people, they have been bootstrapping Go, I think, in two releases, 1.2 and 1.5 for ARM now. And they did it with Docker containers, because that was the best way how to get a complete build environment separate from your host chain, and then build something or cross-compile it so that it can run it on ARM 7, I believe, is what they're working on. Now, that's actually quite cool, because it's quite hard to do it with change routes, because you will always pull in information for more information from your host. You could do it with a full virtual machine, but at that point, you have a lot of hassle. So Docker containers was actually a good choice, and yeah, that's great. Or if you are, say, you are a virtual hosting provider like Host Europe, you might decide that it's not a nice idea to have a lot of a shared web server where we have 50 servers or 50 hosts, 50 users on, and we separate access to them via, say, SUPHP, for example. You could just decide every web server gets a, every customer gets their own Docker container with just an HTTP D in there and a PHP daemon, or PHP fast PHP, or just a PHP mod, or whatever they want to run, mod Ruby, mod Passenger, mod Python, whatever you want to run. And we'll have then the load balancer or the proxy server from Docker redirect the traffic to the right machines. That's actually a really, really interesting use case, but I don't see a lot of people talking about that. It's always still, oh, let's push our code into production with that. And, if you have SE Linux working, you can actually get it quite nicely separated. But if you don't, you can get out of a container. It's kind of like giving root to someone on the internet. If you take a third party random container, right? But if you build the containers yourself, you would get more security, for example, because you're running, you make sure that your Apache is running as nobody in there or as a user. You would be getting way more separation than if you run a multi-user HTTPD on a single machine, right? So it's not perfect. It's not a VM, but it's way better than what we have currently in the multi-user hosting environment, for example. But so that's why I say it's a very sad thing, because all the hype is concentrating on containers as just another packaging format, and it's very backwards, because we want the DevOps benefits, as we've seen. They work. Everybody wants them. I've been working in the financial industry. I see a lot of banks considering how can we use those. How can we use the lessons from DevOps and all that in our environment? We want to roll out code quicker. We've been currently okay with taking down our website for 4 hours in the morning at 4 o'clock and roll out a new release every quarter, and then have 15 people or so get up early to test if everything is okay. But can't we do it better? Maybe. And I know that certain banks, for example, ING in the Netherlands, is very, very involved with the modern computing scene around there. And they go to a lot of the DevOps days. They try to get a lot of input from the community, how they can do things better. And some things work for them, some things fail horribly. It's just they are trying to get 20-year-old, 30-year-old stacks of code, sometimes 40-year-old still running COBOL into a modern environment with a fresher, which never considered those cases when they build these technologies. But for some things, it actually works, and that's quite impressive. But with the DevOps, we want the DevOps benefits, but let's completely ignore everything we learned there. That's not a winning move. It's not really called progress. I think it's called backwards. It's completely backwards, actually. And that's why I'm like, yeah, I'm not a fan of the current hype of the Docker container way. There are better ways to do that. If you look at, for example, the scalability, right? Thank you. There's more, right? We see scalability, how to do it on the internet. It's always very interesting to read how other people do it. There's fascinating reads how Facebook scales out, how Google scales out, and it's something very interesting to take away. The current hype, I think there would be microservices and containers being managed by Kubernetes. It's the latest and greatest. It will solve all your scalability needs, because what you need to do is you take your application, you separate it into special services. So for example, you have a web shop, right? You will have one service which does the querying your warehouse if you have still stuff. You have one different service which will do the authentication. You will have one service which will do the billing. And if you get a nice little armada of services that way, you will have the nice benefit that you can take down one service for maintenance while people can continue surfing through your site. Maybe you can't have new people logging in for the 5 minutes you're doing the rebuild or something, but your full website will still be working. And you can see this, Facebook does that, for example, very often, that you reload the page and suddenly there's a story missing which was there before, or maybe your chat box is loading a little bit slower or anything. These are all different services in the back end. And if a service is not working, that's totally fine. You can still use Facebook. It's just missing a small feature or anything. So the idea is very nice. And if we package those up in containers, we can have a whole fleet of them on a few machines or anything, and then we need a management environment. But the problem with that is there are places where this works and where you can get benefits from that, but realistically, chances are it's not your company, it's not your project. This is, let's say, a typical example you would have is you have your Kubernetes or you have your containers, right? We said before, you manage your hardware, you manage it with Puppet or Chef or Ansible. If you have virtual machines on Amazon, you have AMI images, you probably use Chef on them too, because you don't want to install your central, say, database all the time all over again or anything if you're not using the RDS from Amazon. So you will have some kind of configuration management system. And now you're getting the containers, but it doesn't come with one, and it's suggested you don't get one for that. So you're looking a little bit, what do I do now? Oh, right, there's Kubernetes, right? That's awesome, let's use that. And now you're spending time to build up a completely new infrastructure just for managing your containers without getting any of the synergy effects. And there we got the bingo from your existing hardware. And that's just not a winning move, right? There's a different talk of mine which describes a little bit more how we've actually scaled out massively. It's basically best lessons learned from Booking. But one thing we learned there was growth takes time, right? It does not happen overnight. You will not have the situation that today we had 5 visitors a day, but tomorrow we will have 5 million suddenly, consistently over the next year. So we need to be able to completely scale out from one day from one machine to 5 million to 500 machines. That just does not happen, right? With every order of magnitude you grow, so from 1 to 10, from 10 to 100, from 100 to 1,000 to 10,000 to 100,000 machines, you completely need to revisit your whole architecture. Nothing will work anymore, right? The typical example is one machine, you installed that by hand. 10 machines, you probably kickstarted it, but didn't do anything else. 100 machines, you would probably be looking very much at Puppet or other configuration management systems. 1,000 machines, you will definitely need something automated to install and configure and manage them. 10,000 machines, yeah, Puppet will not work for you anymore because it's just so much change and everything, and there's so many failures. You need something which deals better, takes out machines which fail out of the load balancer. And at that point, a very funny quote from a Facebook engineer was, so I'm looking at a machine which has an error, right? A developer says machine is acting funny. I log into it via SSH and SSH doesn't ask me for my key. So this means I have logged into that machine before. Obviously this was broken before, so let's just trash it completely. We're not even looking at it anymore because, yeah, I would normally not log into it. I would not log in. If I logged in, it was broken. Get rid of it. That's something you will not, that attitude you would not see with 10 machines, right? At 10 machines, you would still be looking at what's actually going on. I need to try to understand what's going on. Let's see how to fix it. So it's a completely different thing, right? And at that point, when you need to redesign your application completely anyway, then you can decide, is it now sensible for me to go for containers? Google, for example, yeah, absolutely. They have a tons of containers and tons of applications. That works. If you're a web shop or a bank or something with 3, 4, 5, maybe even 10 applications, the hassle of running a separate management system for that is not worth it. So look into your existing tools if you can reuse them. And the other one is also from a business perspective. Do you really think that it's a good way to spend your time now, develop all the configuration infrastructure and the management infrastructure and all the code frameworks for your awesome container situation or anything? Or do you think it might be a better way to spend your time maybe writing new features which attract customers to you? Because customers really like features. They couldn't care less how you're running your code. If you're running in a container, if you're running on bare metal, if you're running on VirtualBox or whatever it is you like, right? They don't care. And I think at that point, I'm actually at the kind of at the end of that. I have two more interesting reads. The one is an awesome one. It's called The Future. It's the Future by Paul Bigger. It's on Circle I. It's a very sarcastic view of the current state of distributed systems. So if you're in that into that, go have a read. It's you're rolling on the floor laughing. It explains how a business guy is coming to a web developer and asking, so they say you know how the new things work. Could you please explain to me how it works? And he wants a single web app, something very simple, right? He ends up with about 80 to 90 containers, probably on 8 virtual machines or anything, and a bit of management infrastructure. But it's really great and scales out very nicely for a single web app. Hilarious read. And the other one is, if you're more interested in how we did it, how we built Booking at that point, is 8 rollouts a day. That's a presentation from Christian again. So SlideShare explains a little bit the business requirements a company had at that point, what they decided was important, how they decide how they solve it, and what they had to accept for a company to be able to do 8 rollouts a day. How much errors do you expect a day? How much effort do you need to put into capacity planning? What errors will you find on your way? What are the traps? What works well? What doesn't work? It's, again, a very interesting read. And on another note, if you should be interested in MySQL or MySQL and performance and you're in Amsterdam next month, there's a quite interesting keynote at Percona Live. They're the Percona Performance Consulting company. They have a yearly conference called Percona Live. This year it's in Amsterdam. It's in September. There's a very nice keynote of how Booking was built and using such amazing technologies as bare metal hypervisors, hipster-free technologies such as Apache, MySQL, and Perl, and how you make billions of money with that per year. And I think the keynote title is boring.com. But it's totally worth it because it works. And with that, I guess thank you very much for your attention. Do you have any questions? Thank you. Alex? I expected a question. Or was that to your happiness? All right, perfect. Thank you very much. If you, I don't know, have any other questions, reach out to me on IRC or anything. I'm always happy to share anecdotes and wisdoms. It's great fun. Thank you.